from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Big reactions to the Supreme Court's Hobby Lobby ruling yesterday. The court found that the government can't force family-owned corporations to pay for contraception coverage under the Affordable Care Act on religious grounds. Corporations with religious rights. A narrow decision, said Justice Alito, for the 5-4 majority. Of startling breadth, said Justice Ginsburg in dissent. This hour on Point, the Hobby Lobby ruling and what it means. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Business owners, do you want your religion to write the rule book? Employees, women, is the boss's faith now in charge? Where does this ruling point us? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here outside the Supreme Court yesterday, Hobby Lobby supporters cheer. And here the attorney, Lori Windham, for Hobby Lobby, said the 5-4 decision is something that all Americans should celebrate.
Today's decision is a landmark decision for religious freedom. The Supreme Court recognized that American families do not lose their fundamental rights when they open a family business. Today's victory against this unjust mandate is important not just for families like the Greens, but also for religious ministries like the Little Sisters of the Poor, and for all Americans who seek to live according to their consciences.
The Greens, who own Hobby Lobby, who founded it, the Little Sisters of the Poor, a nonprofit saying that who doesn't want even to offer any access to contraception, even if there's a government accommodation to do that. That goes to whether or not this is a narrow or broad ruling. The president of NARAL, Pro-Choice America, Ilse Hoag, Elise spoke with CNN on the steps of the Supreme Court yesterday, said she was extremely disappointed in the high court's decision.
What we saw today was five male justices essentially ruled that discrimination against women is not discrimination at all. In fact, their narrow judgment said that it's absolutely okay for bosses to make personal decisions for women about our health care, which we pay for with our labor, and that's unacceptable. And make no mistake, as Justice Bader Ginsburg said, this is startling in its breadth. This opens a Pandora box, regardless of what the court has written.
A Pandora's box. Joining me first from Washington is Joan Biskupic. She covers legal affairs for Reuters. Joan, welcome back to On Point. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be here.
As this sinks in, which assessment of it seems to be taking hold? A narrow decision or a decision of startling breadth, as Justice Ginsburg said?
Well, in many ways, it is of startling breadth. But first, I want to say how appropriate it was that you referred to the dueling opinions this way and how the gap between them. Interestingly, those two justices, Samuel Alito and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, sit right next to each other on the bench. And as they were reading portions of their rulings, they were so far apart, even though they were side by side.
No kidding.
But here's the reality. This is the first time that for-profit companies are said to be covered by this 1993 religious freedom law. So that is a groundbreaking decision right off the bat. The question is, how much will it mean down the road? You rightly say that this applies only at this point to closely held for-profit companies. That's the way the majority cast it. But as Justice Ginsburg noted in her dissent, there are plenty of huge family-owned companies out there. For example, the Chicago-based candy giant Mars takes in $33 billion and has 72,000 employees, and that's closely held. Cargill is closely held. So it's the reach could be substantial down the road. Now, what Justice Alito said was, look, this is going to have limited effect on this law because the federal government has some alternatives even for the contraceptive mandate. And he really tried to dismiss her warnings about, vaccinations or other health issues that might be controversial among some religious organizations that wouldn't want to engage in follow through with other federal laws. He said, look, this is just an exaggeration in terms of the effect down the road. We will see soon.
If there's a Pandora's box open here, how far this might go. Joan, help us understand, is this the first time that corporations have been granted religious rights, religious standing. Justice Alito writing for the majority. These were, as critics have pointed out, five men, Republican appointed, but saying that giving for-profit corporations exemption from the law in this case protects the religious liberty of the humans who own and control them. He's quoting him here. He said, any suggestion that for-profit corporations are incapable of exercising a religion because their purpose is simply to make money flies in the face of modern corporate law. Does this mean that corporations, I mean, you know, we heard that they have freedom of speech in Citizens United. Do they now have freedom of religion? And is that new?
Well, it's new as declared by the court yesterday. Let me just say that in 1993, when Congress adopted this law, it did not specifically say that for-profit corporations were covered, but it didn't say they definitely weren't. So
you're talking about the Religious Freedom Restoration Act that Congress almost unanimously passed in 93 that Bill Clinton signed.
Exactly right. And this that was in response to a prior Supreme Court ruling itself that curtailed religious free exercise. So here's the thing that happens up there, Tom. You know, the justices start interpreting a statute, and they view it through different lenses. And here, Justice Alito is stressing, well, it wasn't clear that Congress didn't want for-profit corporations covered by this religious freedom law. And Justice Ginsburg is saying, how could they possibly qualify for this? For-profit corporations aren't exercising religion the way we would think of individuals doing it. So there's a clash in terms of the interpretation. And then when you say how groundbreaking and unprecedented is this, it's unprecedented because the court had never interpreted that provision in the 1993 law. But what the majority is saying is, well, it was sort of already there. It was already there, so we're not really breaking the kind of ground that the majority would say we are. And it was interesting. You've often talked about Justice Anthony Kennedy as the centrist conservative justice who will often, you know, straddle the middle ground. He didn't straddle the middle ground in terms of votes yesterday, but he did write a concurring statement that tried to lower the temperature and essentially said, well, dissenting Justice Ginsburg is really overreading what the majority has done here. But I find it a very respectful and powerful dissent. So he was trying to lower the temperature. But as you know, at the very end of the term, things get really hot. And I think this one's going to be very controversial down the road from both points of view.
Elbow to elbow, practically, Justices Alito in the majority, Justice Ginsburg in the dissent, but yet miles away on this one. Joan Biskupic, covering legal affairs for Reuters, with us from Washington. Joan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
In an interview with One America News Network after the ruling yesterday, Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal said the ruling affirmed the importance of religious liberty.
Religious liberty goes beyond just worshiping in the pews. The reality is, religious liberty created America. America didn't create religious liberty. So, yes, this is about the Green family and Hobby Lobby, but it's more than that.
But out of the White House, Press Secretary Josh Earnest said the administration disagrees with the court's decision in the Hobby Lobby case.
President Obama believes that women should make personal health care decisions for themselves rather than their bosses deciding for them. Today's decision jeopardizes the health of women who are employed by these companies.
Joining us now, two big thinkers on the legal issues at the heart of the ruling with different perspectives from South Bend, Indiana. Richard Garnett joins us, professor of law and political science at Notre Dame, founding director of Notre Dame's interdisciplinary program in church, state, and society. He clerked for Chief Justice Rehnquist at the Supreme Court. Richard Garnett, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks, Tom.
Also with us today from St. Louis, Missouri, is Elizabeth Sepper, professor of law at Washington University and an expert on health law. She wrote an amicus brief to the court arguing that Hobby Lobby's challenge was unconstitutional. Elizabeth Sepper, welcome to you as well.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Elizabeth, narrow or broad, startling breadth, what do you see here?
I see startling breadth, both for the reason that Joan points out that for the first time for-profit corporations exercise religion, also for its effects. But I do want to say whatever we think about the outcome, this opinion radically changes religious liberty law. It throws out every First Amendment case that we have, right? Law works by reference to precedent. Alito says the precedent doesn't matter here because we have the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which throws it all out the window. So we had cases, a case from an Amish sole proprietor challenging Social Security payments. And the court said when you enter into commercial life, you can't impose your values on others, namely employees. And Alito says, wrong. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act does allow business owners to do that. this precedent just doesn't bind us anymore.
Richard Garnett, narrow or broad? How do you see it?
I guess I'm going to say both. So it's it's broad in the sense that the principle underlying the Religious Freedom Restoration Act is a broad one. It's basically that the government, when it can accommodate religion reasonably, it should. I think that's an important principle, and it's been affirmed here. In terms of this opinion, I have to disagree respectfully with Elizabeth and with Justice Ginsburg. I think Justice Alito's characterization is more accurate. RFRA has been on the books now for more than 20 years. We haven't seen a flood of the kind of parade of horrible cases that some people are warning of. It's not the case that this is the first time corporations have been recognized as having religious freedom rights. It's the first case where the Religious Freedom Restoration Act has been interpreted in that way. But again, the act's been on the books for 20 years. So I think Justice Alito's statements that this is a case about a particular set of facts, that it's not deciding every conceivable exemptions claim, is the right way to think about this case. And I think some of the predictions about dire effects have been dramatically exaggerated.
Dire effects that people are concerned about would be a boss laying out a whole raft of religious beliefs and imposing them on employees.
Right. And, you know, here it's essential to the majority's opinion, and it makes this very clear in the opinion, that the government can meet its interests, can achieve its goals without without burning religion, but those goals can still be met. The women are still going to get the coverage to which they're legally entitled.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Hobby Lobby ruling, the Supreme Court, and religion in the workplace and work policy, corporations, religious belief, and you, ultimately, this hour. Elizabeth Sepper is with us, professor of law at Washington University, joining us from St. Louis. Richard Rick Garnett is here from Notre Dame, South Bend, Indiana. They've got almost opposite views on this. We're going to explore that in this hour, and we're going to learn more about the Green family, owners of Hobby Lobby, before this hour is out. Goes back to the 1993 Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the court said. Bill Clinton signed that when he was president. It was passed nearly unanimously in Congress. Had strong support from the Democratic president, Bill Clinton.
We all have a shared desire here to protect perhaps the most precious of all American liberties, religious freedom. Usually the signing of legislation by a president is a ministerial act, often a quiet ending to a turbulent legislative process. Today, this event assumes a more majestic quality because of our ability together to affirm the historic role that people of faith have played in the history of this country. And the constitutional protections those who profess and express their faith have always demanded and cherished.
President Bill Clinton, 1993, celebrating the legislation that the Supreme Court yesterday said can exempt Hobby Lobby and others from getting into birth control they don't want to cover. Outside the high court yesterday, protester Rebecca Harrington said she disagreed with the court's decision.
It's hugely disappointing. It's not what we were hoping for in any way, shape, or form. I think it sets a very dangerous precedent for healthcare, but also for others, you know, freedoms and civil rights.
And here was another dissenter, also a Clinton, Hillary Clinton, at the Aspen Ideas Festival, saying she disagreed with both the court's reasoning and its conclusion.
It's the first time that our court has said that a closely held corporation has the rights of a person when it comes to religious freedom, which means that the corporation, and closely held or often family-based, not exclusively, but usually, that the corporation's employers can impose their religious beliefs on their employees, and of course, denying women the right to contraception as part of their health care plan is exactly that. I find it deeply disturbing.
Hillary Clinton there, and we're talking about employers, their religion, and how it flows through to their employees under this ruling. Elizabeth Sepper, Richard Garnett, please stand by. Lots of callers here. James in Columbia, South Carolina. James, you're on the air. What do you think, sir?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
Well, according to the federal government, a corporation is treated as an individual. And as individual rights, they should have the religious freedoms as every individual in America. If you don't want to give them the individual rights, then you can't say they're recognizing them as an individual corporation where you can't go after the personal effects of the corporate leaders.
And James, what if, it sounds like you support that, but what if your employer followed a religious faith that imposed something onerous on you through your employment relationship? What would you think then?
Right. And that I think that as an individual corporation, as a person, a United States citizen, they should have the right to impose that. It's just like saying that if you're a female and you work for my company, you will take birth control and you cannot have a child.
James, I appreciate your call. Elizabeth Sepper, we can take this ball and run pretty far with it. James is ready to call corporations a corporation a United States citizen. Are we now looking at corporations and saying they've got all the rights that any American would have, period, Elizabeth?
We haven't gone that far yet. Corporations can't vote, of course. The court has, in a number of cases, not extended the same rights to corporations as to individuals. For instance, corporations don't have the right against self-incrimination. They have to produce documents to the government. They can't say, we're not going to talk to you about our criminal wrongdoing. So there's still is a distinction between individuals and corporations, but we are certainly going in the direction where corporations are being given rights that I think most of us would have thought were distinctly personal. Corporations can't go to church. They can't pray. They don't have the core moral beliefs that human beings do.
Rick Garnett, Justice Ginsburg raised this yesterday. She pointed out that corporations enjoy special protections that insulate them from individual liability. That's part of the reason that people incorporate. And then she said, one might ask why the separation between business and owner should hold only when it serves the interest of those who control the corporation. I'm reading here somebody who says she wrote this acidly. What about that? Are corporations having it two ways here, Rick?
Well, I think a key thing to appreciate about this decision and about this question is that the reason why corporations count as persons under the Religious Freedom Act is not because of some metaphysical claim or some theological claim. It's simply because there's a statute called the Dictionary Act, which says that when the term person is used, it's presumed to cover corporations unless Congress indicates otherwise. And they didn't do it here. I mean, in a sense, you mentioned or it was mentioned earlier that Justice Kennedy had tried to kind of turn down the temperature a bit. And I think it's important to remember that with respect to this case and this issue we're talking about, Congress has the power, if it wants to clarify the coverage of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. This is just a statute. It's not the Constitution. And this is a statute that calls for balancing. It doesn't call for categorical wins either for corporations or for employees. It's entirely appropriate to distinguish corporations from individuals in some context, as Elizabeth has mentioned. And in other contexts, it makes perfect sense to treat them similarly. I think it's, again, a matter of case-by-case inquiry and not philosophical deduction from first principles.
We hear the Justice Kennedy kind of calming impulse in your voice, but I don't know if it's a calming perspective or not. Kelly in Austin, Texas. Kelly, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I'm just concerned because I think most people are celebrating this ruling as upholding traditional Christian values. And when I look at it, I just am terrified because it means all religions, even religions you don't agree with necessarily, you know, Christian Scientists, you know, Scientology, Jehovah's Witnesses. And I just don't think that people are seeing the long-range implications of this. They're just right now seeing it as a win for Christianity, which, you know, great, but on down the road, what if you don't agree with, you know, the Muslim owners of a company who are prohibiting pork or, you know, their kind of religious freedom?
Yeah, Kelly, I appreciate your call. How about it, Elizabeth? There may be a kind of cheering the home team for Christian observers of this, but of course, many, many Americans have all kinds of different faiths. Do you see the Pandora's box kind of surprise coming here for people who feel comforted today but may be discomforted tomorrow or next year when their employer of, you know, whatever faith comes up with something that they really don't agree with, Elizabeth?
I think that's right. I think this should be viewed, however, as a loss from the perspective of most Christians. Most women who would consider themselves Christian take contraceptives and don't view them as abortifacients. nor does the medical establishment. But yes, I think one thing that is squarely in the crosshairs here is actually the prohibition on discriminating against your employees because of their religious beliefs. In the past, we did see some cases from there was a for-profit sports club, for instance, who wanted to discriminate against women unless they had a permission slip from their husband or their father to work, did not want to allow non-fundamentalist Christians in management, and discriminated against people who were in unmarried couples. And there the company lost. It was a for-profit corporation, and the court simply would not allow it to claim it was exercising religion. But after Hobby Lobby, I don't know how a court can easily conclude that. And the court here does also change the standard a court has to use in terms of determining whether there's a compelling interest. It says you can only evaluate the government's compelling interest vis-a-vis the specific challenger. The problem is the government has no compelling interest in any particular place of employment complying with anti-discrimination laws. It's an overall societal goal.
What does this mean when it comes to, let's say, on down, you could go down a list of things you can easily imagine people objecting to, gay marriage, some religious faiths don't go for vaccination, I mean, Scientologists don't go for psychiatry, might not want to cover that, Jehovah's Witnesses don't like procedures that require whole blood products, that might mean surgery. Do you see a potential march down that road where people start bringing challenges to lots of things with religious objections, Elizabeth?
I do. Right now, we already know that there's a challenge by nonprofit religious organizations, even to this accommodation that was discussed in the Hobby Lobby case. They don't want their employees to have access to contraception at all from an insurance company. And the 11th Circuit has already read Hobby Lobby to require them to issue a stay in those challengers' favor. We also have had very recent challenges to workers' compensation from Montana Big Sky Colony. I think they would be quite emboldened by the Hobby Lobby ruling. There are ongoing challenges from for-profit pharmacies that don't want to fill prescriptions that a doctor has written a woman for contraceptives. And there are ongoing litigation by florists, bakers, and the like against requirements that they serve same-sex couples without discrimination when it comes to their wedding day. So that's the most immediate extension. But I think it goes well beyond that. We've seen that a lot of religious organizations do have objections to other social insurance programs like unemployment compensation and Social Security. They previously lost those cases, but I think they're going to be encouraged to come back into the courts and put the government through their paces.
Rick, on the other side, the Green family, which founded Hobby Lobby and still are right there in the middle of it, they say, well, we don't want to be tied to things that offend our religious belief. This is being described as a victory for that view. How far does that view extend under this ruling, Rick?
So it doesn't extend as far as I think some of these predictions of scary cases would suggest. This case does not say that employers have a carte blanche right to impose religious beliefs on their employees. As Elizabeth pointed out, federal law does protect employees from religious discrimination in the workplace, and this decision does not undermine that protection.
Well,
doesn't it
crack open a path to challenge that, saying, look, my religion tells me gay marriage is wrong, so, hey, high court, look at my case.
Yeah, so such challenges will certainly be brought, as Elizabeth has mentioned, some have been already. But again, I think it's important to emphasize that this law has been on the books for more than 20 years, and we have not seen this flood of these kinds of cases that are being threatened now.
Well, and isn't that partly because it's never had this kind of ruling from the high court? Isn't that the big difference today?
I don't believe so. That could be part of the explanation, but I think what, you know, Hobby Lobby case is here, not because corporations suddenly discovered the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, but because the mandate in question here was a new public policy at the federal level. Corporations have enjoyed constitutional rights and statutory rights for a long time. This case does not create those rights. And if there was going to be a flood of corporations making such claims, I think we would have seen some hint of them before now. In the decision itself, also, I just think it's important to underscore this, that there's no reason, in Justice Alito's opinion, to say that all of a sudden social insurance laws or health and safety regulations, let alone anti-discrimination laws, are suddenly going to be wiped out. RFRA calls for a balancing act. The balance went in the Greens' favor in this case, not because they just sort of came forward and said, we don't want to have to comply, but because the government wasn't able to show that the mandate was the least restrictive means of asserting its interest. In many cases, and certainly in the context of discrimination law, the government's going to have a very strong argument that the anti-discrimination law's application is the least restrictive means of asserting its compelling interest, and employers who challenge those under RFRA will almost certainly lose.
Elizabeth, is there a firewall right there against the kind of concerns that some people have of wider application?
I don't think challenge to anti-discrimination laws is a wider application. Hobby Lobby allows for the challengers here to discriminate against women. Make no mistake, failing to meet women's health needs in a health insurance plan while meeting all of men's needs is discrimination. And the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission held so, as did a number of federal courts in the 2000s. And that's really what prompted employers to start covering contraception in their plans. So I think there is squarely a threat to anti-discrimination laws. I think Justice Alito was very careful to say that with regard to racial discrimination, the government has a compelling interest. But Justice Ginsburg noted in dissent, the majority only grudgingly assumed that there could be a compelling interest in gender equality here. And I think that's a real problem for women in the workplace going forward.
Jessica in Louisville, Kentucky. Jessica, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to ask if this could be some kind of impetus to get rid of a job sponsored health care. I mean, this wouldn't be an issue if a job just compensated you with money and then you bought your own health care. Thank you.
Yeah, so cut the tie to employer-sponsored health care. Elizabeth, is that the answer here? Just get away from the connection. I mean, easy to say, hard to do in this country.
Yes, I think at heart that's the problem. It would be great, and certainly this case brings forward why it is deeply irrational to funnel health insurance through employment. And one solution could be simply to just put all employees on the exchanges. We don't even have to go to single payer.
The Obamacare exchanges.
Obamacare exchanges, mm-hmm. That's right, where they could have where we could increase wages and they could purchase the insurance separate from their employer. But it brings us back to a point here. One reason this was a strange lawsuit from a health care perspective is that, as Jessica notes, I mean, compensation includes both wages and benefits. So really, the employees are earning their health insurance. So it's a bit strange for their employers to then object to how they spend their benefits.
Rick, we heard that from others as well here today. The employers have paid for this. Who's the high court or the employer to tell them they can't have it?
Yeah, and again, the Hobby Lobby wins in this case only because the court was convinced that these employees were going to get the coverage that to which federal law entitles them via another efficient mechanism. If the outcome of a Hobby Lobby win would have been that these employees would have been denied that coverage to which they're legally entitled, then Hobby Lobby would have lost.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Hobby Lobby ruling, the Supreme Court, and religion in the workplace, work policy, corporations, religious belief, and you this hour. Richard Garnett is with us from Notre Dame University, South Bend, Indiana. Elizabeth Sepris here from St. Louis at Washington University. Law professors, both with different perspectives on this. We're going to hear about the Green family of Oklahoma and their Hobby Lobby company. Lots of questions. Alex in Stowe, Ohio. Alex, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom, Elizabeth, Richard. My question has to do with something I saw online a while back and have not been able to validate or invalidate.
Mm-hmm.
Someone had posted that Hobby Lobby provides, or that something to the tune of 17 types of contraceptives, birth control, out of the 20-odd that are available. And I'm wondering if any of you have heard anything about that. And if it's so, does that change the conversation or the effects as a whole?
Alex, I think that's essentially true. Elizabeth, what about that argument? Look, they offer lots of birth control. It's just a few kinds that they find tantamount to abortion. Others do not, but they do, and they don't want to offer those. So our caller's suggesting, what's the big deal?
I think as a PR matter, that does work. But we're in a universe where there are about 100 cases involving for-profit challengers to the contraceptive mandate. Many of them object to covering any contraception at all. And even though Hobby Lobby, like all court cases, applies only to the facts in front of it, only to those challengers, it'd be extremely difficult to read it as not allowing those challengers to prevail as well. The other issue, of course, is that this is about cost, and IUDs are among the most expensive but most effective forms of birth control. So it is very important that women be able to access contraceptive coverage. I mean, Rick has said a couple times that women will still get coverage. That's not entirely clear. They might still get coverage in the case of Hobby Lobby, but it's not clear, right? Their lawyer before the Supreme Court said they would evaluate that and decide whether they had religious objections if they were offered the accommodation that nonprofits got. So the government might come back and offer this accommodation to them and find that they still have religious objections and simply want the government to pay.
Rick, what about that? We heard in tape at the early in the hour Hobby Lobby's attorney saying they were celebrating, but also kind of looking forward and citing in particular a group that is not a religious group that doesn't want to accept the government alternative accommodation here. Does that suggest Hobby Lobby may not be finished yet?
Well, I want to start by saying I think Elizabeth is right that this decision is not limited to particular claimants who object only to specific forms of contraception. I think that's right. But I guess I still do maintain that it's a premise of this Hobby Lobby case that the female employees do have to get the coverage that they're entitled to under the Affordable Care Act. It's all about how that coverage is delivered. Hobby Lobby might well, I suppose, file another lawsuit if the administration's response is to give them the Little Sisters accommodation. I suspect they'd probably not prevail, but maybe they would. But even if they did bring such a lawsuit, it would still be necessary for them to establish not only that there was a burden, but that the government could reasonably accommodate them. And the government might well be able to come back and say, no, this is the best we can do. This is the only way to serve our compelling state interest. And if they were able to establish that, then Hobby Lobby would lose. The RFRA statute requires a balance. It doesn't say that the religious claimants always win. It doesn't even say that they usually win. They only win if the government can serve its compelling interest via another way.
So we don't know where they'll go, but they got a big victory under their belt right now, sort of feeling their oats there in their attorney's statements. One more here. Austin, Texas. John, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm very concerned about this ruling. It seems to me that this enables an employer to regulate the behavior of his or her employees according to that employer's religious tenets. I think, for example, of someone of the Mormon faith who owns a company and then tells their employees, look, now you can't drink alcohol, you can't smoke, you can't use tobacco products, you can't drink coffee, you can't drink Coke, you can't drink any soft drink with a caffeine in it. You can't use drugs of any kind, ever. Not only is that my religion, but these are all demonstrated scientifically to be injurious to your health anyway. So I'm invoking this Religious Freedom Act in order to get you to do the right thing.
Yeah, John, we've got it. I appreciate your call from Austin. I mean, I've just got you for another minute, Rick and Elizabeth, but how about it? Rick, first to you. A lot of people have thought, you know, John's worried about employers regulating employees' life. The Americans have embraced freedom of religion for a long time, but I think there was this sense that, fine for you, boss, but don't tread on me. It's like, absolutely, employer, have your religious beliefs, but let me have mine. Let me exercise mine.
Yeah, this decision, I think, should not give rise to those concerns. Hobby Lobby's objection, its religious freedom claim, had nothing to do with its employees' behavior. What Hobby Lobby said is, the government is making us do something that we feel we ought not to do.
But it was intimately related with the employer's behavior. It was related with their birth control.
Sure. But they would have lost if they tried to say, because we religiously oppose contraception, we are going to require that all of our employees not use contraception, or we are going to forbid our employees from buying it. Federal law currently and state law almost everywhere protects employees in the workplace from religious discrimination, and this statute, this ruling rather, doesn't change that.
Elizabeth Sepper, have we moved the needle here from fine, you have your religion, but don't tread on me? Is it a little bit different to the regulation fear of our caller in Austin?
I think I tend to agree with Rick on this particular example. I do think, though, that when it comes to gender, when it comes to women's sexuality, we will see employers making claims that, in fact, they are allowed to discriminate. They're not discriminating on the basis of sex, they'll say. They're just exercising religion. So maybe they'll fire unmarried pregnant women. Maybe they will refuse to cover IVF because they're Catholic and believe it's morally prohibited. So I do think that the regulation of behavior is implicit in this decision. It's certainly about shifting costs onto employees instead of employers.
We're going to turn to the Oklahoma story, which is now a national story of Hobby Lobby itself and the Green family, but I'm very grateful to the two of you for being with us this hour. Richard Garnett at University of Notre Dame in South Bend, thank you very much for joining us, Rick.
Thank you.
And Elizabeth Sepper, professor of law at Washington University in St. Louis. Elizabeth, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Let's get to know the Green family a little better. Owners, founders of Hobby Lobby. Here in March, Hobby Lobby co-founder Barbara Green spoke outside the Supreme Court after lawyers had made their oral arguments.
Our family started Hobby Lobby, built on our faith and together as a family. We've kept that tradition for more than 40 years, and we want to continue to live out our faith and the way we do business. The choice that the government has forced on us is unfair and not in keeping with the history of our great nation founded on religious freedom.
Outside the Supreme Court in March, after the Hobby Lobby decision was announced yesterday, a video was released with a statement from Hobby Lobby co-founders David and Barbara Green. Barbara here speaking for the couple, thanking the company's employees, customers, and supporters.
The Supreme Court reaffirmed what our family has always believed, that America is a country founded on and sustained by religious liberty. It's been a long journey, but an important one for our family and for those who wish to be guided in all areas of life, including their businesses, by faith and conscience.
Time magazine has a big article on the Green family and Hobby Lobby in the current issue. David Van Bima wrote the piece for Time. He's with us right now from New York City. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Tell us about the Green family and the origins of Hobby Lobby.
Well, the Green family is a multi-generational family. David and Barbara, David is the patriarch and sort of the retail genius behind this huge fortune. He was the country's 79th richest man a couple of years ago and is probably right up there now. And he came out of a very, very conservative Pentecostal background. It's called, that church is called the Church of God of Prophecy. And not only does the church, or did the church, and does the church believe in the inerrancy of Scripture, but it also was the kind of church that strongly discouraged bowling for fear that you might come into, you know, a possible temptation to sin. Out of that came a bunch of Greens of David's generation, and all of his brothers and sisters, and there were five of them, became either pastors, pastors' wives, or in the case of one of his sisters, an evangelist. And when he started making money, and he started, I mean, he's very, very good at it, he felt badly. He described himself as feeling like a black sheep because he had not gone into the ministry. And what he did was to really, at that point, he began turning his business into kind of a quasi-ministry of its own.
How did the business get started, David? How did they go from Oklahoma Pentecostals, largely preachers and preachers' wives, to David's case and then more, running, owning this giant craft store chain.
David is a genius. David started working out at a Five and Dime store. He realized that he knew how to sell things at a retail level better than the people he was working for. They started out by making, or he started out by having his family make tiny little frames in their kitchen for paintings. That was kind of a vogue. A Midwestern vogue was at that time was making little paintings of your own and putting them in little frames. And he saw a market niche. And they started making these things, and they have grown concentrically from Oklahoma City. The stores are now big box stores. They sell all kinds of craft equipment and home, you know, home decoration sorts of equipment.
How many stores now? How many employees?
I think it's about 620 stores and 28,000 employees.
Wow. And how does religion, the Green family's religion, infuse the life of the business at this point?
Well, it really infuses it fairly fully. I mean, this is why they're such a brilliant choice as part of this case. They were asked to be part of the case by the Beckett Fund, and the Beckett Fund knew what it was doing.
They were sort of recruited to be out front on this. Why?
Yeah, they were recruited because they are as good an example of a large business as you can possibly find that is almost a ministry itself. They on a superficial level, they play Christian music along with their Muzak.
In the stores, yeah.
In the stores, that's correct. They have chaplains who evangelize not only to sort of nominal Christians on staff, but to everybody, including non-Christians on staff. Corporate meetings begin sometimes with prayer.
They're closed on Sundays in respect for the Sunday church attendance.
On a very substantial, substantive money level, they decided I think it was about 2000, to close on Sundays, which is a multi-hundred-million-dollar hit on their revenues. Because they wanted people to have time for family and prayer, and they also began raising their starting salary high above the Oklahoma minimum wage. It now more than doubles the Oklahoma minimum wage, also with a Christian proviso. So in terms of the way that the store is run, it's very Christian, infused with Christianity, and also in terms of the family's giving, they give away millions and millions, well, tens and possibly hundreds of million dollars a year to various evangelical causes. And they claim that they give away, you know, between 40 and 50% of their revenues.
You write in Time magazine that there's a very established effort underfoot to put religion more deeply back at the center of American life, public life, business life. They were recruited to come in and be the lead plaintiff here, or one of the two. Is the Green family itself embracing this role now, of sort of public advocates, crusaders even?
I think that they are embracing the role. I think that they got into it somewhat reluctantly. They prayed for weeks. A couple of years ago, they were praying regularly that they would not have to do this, but they were praying that basically that the Obamacare would be struck down by the Supreme Court. And when it wasn't, when the personal mandate was sustained, then they basically said, okay, we have to do this. But in point of fact, this is not really their... the thing that they love the most, the stuff that they love the most is yet to come, and they, unlike...
What does that mean?
What it means is this, is like, you know, everybody's heard of the Scopes trials, but nobody's heard of Scopes, because Scopes was a school teacher who was basically recruited to speak in favor of the, you know, non-religious...
We're talking about the trial about evolution versus creationism.
Yeah,
yes.
And
where are they going? Our time grows short.
The trial was over. Nobody heard of him. These guys are going to be around for a long time. They are one of the two things that they're doing is that they are developing a Bible curriculum. They've put millions of dollars into it already, and they're testing it now in a school district in Oklahoma. for the Bible to be taught as a course, an elective course, in the public schools. And they hope to have it in thousands of public schools within a couple of years.
And they're a big mover in this move to open an enormous Bible museum just off the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Where's that stand?
The question of whether interior work is already underway on the building is an interesting one, but they have bought the land, and they have it's five blocks from the Capitol, and it's going to be a $440 million museum, and it's going to house part of their 45,000 object collection of biblical artifacts. And symbolically speaking, because it will be evangelically tinged, and we can talk about what that might mean, mm-hmm. it's kind of like putting a marker down on, and it's very close to the Washington Mall. And if you look at the Washington Mall as this gigantic sort of identity scorecard where there's an African American museum nearby and the Holocaust Museum, yeah. and at some point or another, there'll probably be a gay and lesbian museum. They will be responsible, you know, for a Bible museum, which is interesting to anybody, but a Bible museum that has a certain taste to it, and from that point of view, it will be a big evangelical chit on the mall.
We've just got 20 seconds. What's the goal? Is the goal to recreate a Christian nation?
I think the Green family, I think, sort of differs from person to person and generation to generation. I think that they feel that they, there's no question that most of them feel that the country has deviated from what they feel are its Christian roots. How far they want to go and try to bring it back to its Christian roots, that may differ from family member to family member, but the museum and the curriculum. You see, the curriculum
it's a big push right there. We're out of time, David Bima. We can see it. Billionaires on the move there. David Bima with Time Magazine. Thank you so much for your insight. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.